You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am joined for this first post the Grandest Tour podcast, and it's a press conference episode, this one, by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And returning to the podcast, Daniel Freeb.
Hello, giving a reprieve. Allowed back into the fold.
Oh, you're always going to be allowed back in, Daniel, after your stint working for the telly. Have you both recovered? I mean, Lionel, you and I had 35 or pretty much, well, we as a collective put out 35 or so episodes in a row. And Daniel, you've been living on the Grand Tour circuit ever, really pretty much since Palermo, all that time ago.
Yeah, and how long, that was what, 2 weeks after the Tour de France? And yeah, I've been on the road really since the start of August, was it? When was the Dauphiné? The start of August?
Yeah, how are the sensations? Are the sensations good?
Yeah, good. I'd happily take on another Grand Tour. The US Masters is really the fourth Grand Tour to enjoy from one's couch anyway. So I'm enjoying that this week.
If there was another Grand Tour now, where would you like it to be? Portugal or somewhere like that?
Portugal's, Switzerland would be a nice one. Or just do another lap of the ones we've already done.
Brilliant. What a dream scenario. Would you like, does that appeal to you, Lionel?
Well, I love the off-season. So
Tour of Hertfordshire, Napalm, is that where you live?
Yeah, do live in Hertfordshire. God, you've got it right after all these years. Amazing. Amazing. It's only taken you 7 years. It's strange that it's mid-November and, well, we assume it will all be firing up again early-ish in the new year. No Tour Down Under, unfortunately. I know people will think it's strange. I don't dislike the Tour Down Under at all, but it will be. I'll miss it. I'll have an opportunity to miss it this year. And then,
I mean, in your alternative calendar that you unveiled in Sunday's podcast, Lionel, you omitted the Tour Down Under, which one or two Australian listeners spotted.
Well, I've published the alternative calendar in our newsletter, and I've corrected that omission. I didn't mean to leave it out. I just meant that, you know, that I don't think there's any dispute about having some World Tour events outside Europe. In maybe in January and February, leading up to kind of, you know, having some kind of Australian, Far East, Middle East swing on one side, and then a South American, North American swing at the same time on the other side, and then the whole show reconvenes in Europe in the spring. I think could work, but I mean, you know,
what about the Bay Crits, mate? The Bendigo Classic, the Bendigo Medicine, mate.
Yeah, and the well, yeah, the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Pedalo Race. I'm just making matters worse for myself.
Come
here,
back, Australia. Come back. Don't turn off your radios. Well, as I said, this is a press conference episode. We got a lot of questions sent to us by audio, so we'll hear your voices, which is nice. We're going to try and get through as many of them as we can. Spoiler alert: we won't get through them all. So. Thanks very much if you did send in a question. We'll hear them throughout this episode and then answer them. We'll also hear from our guest presenters during the Grandest Tour, Francois Thomazeau, Lizzie Banks and Ian Boswell. They have answered some of your questions as well.
No, guest presenters, are they now? What am I just am I just a guest now?
Well, you should be flattered, Daniel, that it took three people to replace you.
Okay.
I mean, one Lizzie Banks plus one Ian Boswell plus one Francois Thomazeau equals one Daniel Freeb, clearly.
Lovely, lovely stuff.
any news, though, Lionel? There has been a bit of news.
Yeah, just
the Grandest Tour finish.
Just a few snippets. We'll get back into the swing of the cycling news in a week or two, really, but this is a press conference episode. But there are a few things just to remark upon. One is that Alex Dowsett is going to tackle the hour record on December the 12th in Manchester. Dowsett held the record in May 2015 when he broke Rowan Dennis's record. Saying record a bit too much now, aren't I? But Dowsett's record, stood for a little over a month before Bradley Wiggins then broke it. It's, of course, held at the moment by Victor Campenaerts, and the mark is 55.089 kilometres. So Alex Dowsett going to use his form from the Giro, where he won a stage, of course, to build up to an hour record attempt. It'll be interesting to see whether he goes close or whether he can take the record back. And we'll find out in a month's time.
Victor Campenaerts, yep. Napalm, who could, of course, be teamless.
Yes.
I think he's got a contract for NTT. He's one of about seven or eight riders who still have a contract with NTT, but their future is very much up in the air still, isn't it?
It is. Well, Doug Ryder had been making quite positive noises, suggesting that maybe a replacement for NTT was going to be unveiled fairly soon. But then this week we've heard that Bjarne Riis has stepped down from his role at NTT. The plan had originally been for Riis's organisation and Ryder's organisation to sort of join forces. But as we heard in that Kilometre Zero episode we made about the team, NTT, SOS, that was never formalised, that arrangement. So the management company remained Doug Ryder's, and the search for a sponsor, as far as we know, is ongoing. And that will leave quite a number of riders, Campenaerts among them, looking for alternatives that are really, you know, after closing time, really, isn't it, in terms of looking for a contract for 2021. Not an awful lot of space is available, I wouldn't have imagined. Dylan Groenewegen has been suspended for 9 months by the UCI for causing the crash which injured Fabio Jakobsen of De Koninck Quickstep quite badly. Groenewegen, who rides for Jumbo-Visma, of course, penalised very heavily. I don't know what you guys think about that decision. 9 months for, as the UCI put it, deviating from his racing line in the sprint does seem a really hefty penalty.
I think you do know what I think about the decision. I think it's an appalling decision. We actually talked a little bit about this in the cycling podcast Femina this week as well, because it's been an issue in women's cycling too. The sort of inconsistency of punishments for offences in sprint finishes, and yeah, as you say, this very harsh punishment is for deviating from his line. No more detail, nothing about the dangerous finish, you know, very fast downhill finish, and defective barriers as well. That certainly made Jakobsen's terrible injuries even worse. So no responsibility borne, it seems, by the UCI or the Tour of Poland, and everything kind of put on Dylan Groenewegen, who, you know, was guilty of a dangerous manoeuvre, undoubtedly, and did deserve to be relegated. But, you know, I think that the punishment here is owes a lot to the outcome, i.e. the severity of the injuries, rather than the offence itself, because we've seen similar or worse in other sprints where perhaps nobody has ended up crashing. But, you know, off the top of my head, Pascal Ackermann has been guilty this year of a couple of very dangerous manoeuvres. On one occasion, it actually won him the stage at Tirreno Adriatico, and on another occasion at Skelderpriest, he did cause a big crash. I think it's an appalling decision by the UCI, and also shameful that they offered so few details about exactly why he's been given such a severe punishment. I'm surprised that his team, Jumbo-Visma, have accepted it.
Well, nominally, chaps, it's about Groenewegen deviating from his line in that sprint in Tour of Poland. But what this sanction is effectively saying is that sprinters have to have, there has to be a kind of real-time calculation that they have to make about how dangerous what they're doing is, which, it's no longer just about holding a line, not holding a line. In this instance, you know, should Groenewegen have implicitly known and taken stock of the fact that it was a very fast finish, and that if he had deviated, if he did deviate even, you know, not even half a metre, I suppose, was his deviation, then it could cause a dire crash like the one we saw with Groenewegen. Because there's no doubt about it that we see much bigger deviations. I mean, I immediately thought of Julien Alaphilippe's Liège-Bastogne-Liège, of course. Alaphilippe lost that race, well, initially when he celebrated prematurely and Primoz Roglic sneaked under his arm to win, but then Alaphilippe was disqualified for that manoeuvre. But that was really a huge manoeuvre. And, just on the point of Jumbo-Visma and them seeming to accept the sanction, I wonder how different it might have been had it been a less successful team than Jumbo-Visma. Their focus, their emphasis has very much been on the Grand Tours and winning Grand Tours in the last 3 or 4 months, and indeed the last couple of years. And Dylan Groenewegen is probably more expendable in that team than he would be in any other team. And the other thing that I sort of noticed and I considered was how the kind of tides of sympathy towards or against Dylan Groenewegen might be affected by this very severe sanction. It struck me that having very much condemned Groenewegen in quite explicit and in some cases extreme terms, the sort of court of public opinion swayed almost back in his favour with this sanction, because the perception is that he's kind of being hard done by.
Just briefly on that, because we don't want to spend too long on it, but I see what you're saying, but it also the sanction also sort of legitimizes some of the abuse that he's got. My opposition to it is nothing to do with Groenewegen himself. It's about the decision and the precedent that it sets, because, as you say, Daniel, the responsibility, almost sort of, they're being put in charge of health and safety of these finishers as well, sprinters. The decisions they make have to be influenced by, the road furniture or the gradient or the positioning of barriers. And as I say, in that crash, there were a number of factors that went into Jakobsen's injuries being so bad. And it wasn't just Groenewegen's manoeuvre. It was also the downhill finish and the defective barriers.
I mean, some might say, Rich, that even when you're driving a car, you're making those sort of implicit kind of calculations about how dangerous certain things are all the time. Going 10 kilometers an hour over a speed limit on a certain road is much worse than it would be in other circumstances. So,
That is true.
Well, Groenewegen's suspension will be completed on May the 7th, which is the day before the Giro d'Italia. Which is your birthday, yeah.
An irrelevant point, but...
It's also, more significantly from the point of view of the world of cycling, it's also the day before the Giro starts in 2021. Just lastly, the Tour de Yorkshire 2021 will not happen. They're hoping to bring the race back in 2022. They've cited the coronavirus situation and the uncertainty surrounding all of that as the reason to not go ahead with organising a race that may well not... But it might not be possible to hold it as normal. So ASO and Welcome to Yorkshire have made this decision. Shouldn't overlook the fact that Welcome to Yorkshire has been facing difficulties since the CEO, Gary Verity, resigned last spring after admitting a series of errors of judgment regarding his expenses. And Welcome to Yorkshire had also been a bit strapped for cash and had asked for public funds to plug a few gaps. So probably more than one factor involved, but they are hoping to bring back the Tour de Yorkshire for 2022.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
Thanks very much indeed to our title sponsor, iWalker. We are very grateful to them for their support. And if you run a small business or you know someone who runs a small business, iWalker can maybe help you. Go to iwalker.co.uk and see all the information that they have there for small businesses, and in particular information about the finance they can offer. That's iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Let's go to our first question.
Hi guys, this is Ben from Beverley in East Yorkshire, and I have a question for Daniel about his famous, maybe infamous, wine glass rating for Grand Tours. What I want to know is, what does it take for a Grand Tour to get 5 wine glasses out of 5? To my knowledge, only one tour has ever achieved this. That was the 2003 Tour de France. But to me, the best tour I've ever seen was the 2018 Giro, where you had Chris Froome's epic ride, Simon Yates animating the race from start to finish, and all sorts going on. But Daniel only gave that one 4 glasses out of 5, I think. I'm starting to wonder if this is, what happens when people enter the middle age and they stop listening to new songs and they only remember the old songs they loved. Is that what's going on, Daniel? Or could a tour still get 5 glasses out of 5? Tell us what would it take?
Well, thank you, Ben. A question for you, Daniel. A very good question.
I'd love to know the answer. I feel like the listenership has really changed since I've been away.
I think they've just got to know you. Much more hostile.
Come on, Daniel. What would it take?
Well, Rich, I shall not give away the formula for my wine glass ratings. It's a bit like the recipe of Coca-Cola and indeed the origins of Lionel's nickname. It shall never be revealed. However, I think people overestimate the extent to which it is a judgment of the general classification battle in a Grand Tour. We talked about this. You asked me, well, when we were talking about the Vuelta the other day and trying to sort of evaluate it. Again, you know, I'd had some sort of feedback on social media talking about how exciting it was or wasn't. And again, people taking maybe slightly one-dimensional look at the race. And one of the things that can really drag a Grand Tour down, in my view, is a high proportion of stages where the transitional stages or the sprint stages where not too much is happening and it's not very integrated with the overall sort of narrative of the race, i.e. the GC battle. And that was the great thing I thought about the Vuelta this year, when the GC battle was never dormant, really. And sometimes you had to look quite hard for things happening on GC, but they were always happening pretty much. There were two or three sprint stages where you could say that it sort of retreated, paled into insignificance, the GC battle, but it was always kind of there, evolving slowly in the background. And so the sprint stages are important. The transitional stages are important, but also other things like conceptually, you know, where does the Grand Tour go? Does it represent a great kind of journey? Does it show off the country to its best effect? Things along those lines are also factored in. One thing that has struck me, looking back at some of my former ratings, is that, so this is partly inspired, that the wine glass rating, by the most famous sort of gauge of wines, is the Robert Parker, the Wine Advocate. Robert Parker scores out of 100, Robert Parker being the most famous wine critic in the world. And what he does, he evaluates wines as he tastes them. So a 1982 Chateau Petrus might be a 93 when he tastes it in 1995, and it might be an 88 when he tastes it 10 years later. And I feel I've sort of kept the ratings that I originally gave each of the Grand Tours, but I do feel that I should reevaluate some of them now.
Well, I was going to ask, I've got two questions for you, Daniel. One is, if 2003 was only five wine glass Grand Tour,
yeah,
which one has come closest to emulating that?
Oh, well, the listener there, sorry, I forget the...
Ben.
Ben did mention the 2018 Giro, and it did lead me to question that and to go back and look. And, I mean, the 2018 Giro had a great last 3 days, which I think is increasingly the case in Grand Tours, because we're seeing them set up to be very close. The organiser almost contriving this suspense packed into the last 3 or 4 days, and that was the case there. You know, I thought the first week was slightly underwhelming, but 2018 Giro would be close. I think I would have to
And my second question, Daniel, is what's your favorite album of all time?
Who's asking that?
I'm asking that.
It would be Nas, Illmatic, I think.
Okay.
Quite clearly. Have you ever heard of him?
Ben's suggestion. I'm just glossing over that because I don't know what you're talking about.
Nothing to do with the Italian drugs police that often used to visit the Giro d'Italia.
Coldplay or something.
No, certainly not.
Hi lads, it's Stuart here, recording from a lockdown in Buckinghamshire on the Stage 13 time trial at the Vuelta. I noticed that Dan Martin was riding a new TT bike, a new Factor TT bike. I wasn't sure if it was a modified Road Astro their new road bike. It was modified with TT bars. Or if it's a completely new bike, I didn't see it reported in the press anywhere, so I thought it could be a world exclusive.
Thanks for the question, Stuart. That's a very, very good spot there, very eagle-eyed viewing. And Factor are releasing a new bike next year. And the reason that Dan Martin was riding it in the Vuelta time trial is the same reason that one of the Ceratizit WNT riders was on a brand new Orbea. And that is because next year is an Olympic year. And if you want to be able to ride a frame in the Olympics, it has to have been raced in competition the year before. And of course, the manufacturers were under time pressure to be able to get these frames available so that the riders were able to race them in the final time trial of the year. And of course, with the Vuelta having been in question because of the coronavirus pandemic, it was really touch and go whether, you know, both Factor and Orbea were going to be able to get their new frames raced this year. So quite often you'll see a kind of a blacked out frame if the frame's not ready yet. But once it's been raced in competition, then it's able to be used in the Olympics the following year.
Hello to all of you. This is Jim in Liverpool. Firstly, I'd like to thank all of the team at the Cycling Podcast. I became interested in professional cycling last year, and it was through your podcast, really, that I began to understand the sport and the world around it. So I just want to say I'm extremely grateful to that. I have actually, since last year, moved into a sort of cycling-related career, working for a charity called Cycling Projects. And I think that's, you know, very large part due to the interest in kind of professional cycling that was sparked by listening to your podcast. So thank you. My question comes from that of someone that's a football fan, really, originally. And it's about the teams and how they're sponsored and funded. Now, I know this is a long-standing matter that comes up quite a lot in the podcast itself. And also, you know, it's mentioned quite frequently that the funding structure of cycling teams is really in need of some kind of reform. But I'd be interested to hear from all of you, really, what you think could be done in this way, how this sport might be structured differently in terms of funding. I myself find it, you know, interesting trying to think of a team to support, I suppose, given, you know, the various different backers, and trying to explain at times to friends and my wife, you know, why it is that I'm cheering for a supermarket chain, or, you know, have a difficulty in you know, supporting a petrochemical giant. How do you kind of respond to that as well? Do you tend not to look at the teams and you think more about the riders? Is it something that even you have to just put out of your mind as a cycling fan?
Thanks very much for your question, Jim. And it's great to hear that you are new to the sport and that you feel like you've got a lot out of the podcast. That's very nice to hear indeed. So hope you keep listening. Thank you. And it's a great question as well. As you say, it is a sort of perennial question around cycling. And one of the quirks, I suppose, the nature of the companies that sponsor and, you know, give their names to the teams. And I was particularly interested in your question about, you know, how do you as a fan pick a team to support? And I suppose I'm thinking back to when I became interested in the sport and, you know, why I liked the teams that I liked. And certainly wouldn't have been anything to do with the business of the sponsor, more to do with the riders and the colour of the kit, I think. I don't know. I mean, Lionel, you're of a similar vintage. What you know, can you think back to what it was and how you reconcile this curious factor in professional cycling that the teams are not? And Jim mentions that he comes from a football background. You're obviously a big Watford fan. Cycling does have a difficulty, doesn't it, in, you know, attracting that sort of engagement with fans through teams, which is such an important part of other team sports, and a bit of a challenge when it comes to professional cycling.
Yeah, because I think people instinctively support individuals rather than the teams, don't they? And certainly at first glance, the whole Tour de France is about who wins the race rather than which team is going to be strongest. And I suppose thinking back to the first few tours I watched in 1986, Richard, a tour you know very well, obviously the whole narrative was the battle between two teammates, Bernardino and Greg LeMond. And I suppose that the split between them in terms of them being rivals but riding for the same team sort of confused the matter even further for me. And when I think back to that 86 tour, you know, one thing that really I only appreciated when I, you know, got older, I suppose, and read more about the tour and understood more about the sport was that, you know, they also had obviously Andy Hampston in fourth place. They won stages with Nicky Ruterman and Jean-Francois Bernard, I think. And they were the absolute, you know, they were the Liverpool of that Tour de France, weren't they? They absolutely cleaned up. And yet the whole story was about Le Monde versus Hinault. It wasn't about Lavie Claire, which at the time I probably didn't even know was a health food shop, a French chain of health food shops. That didn't really register with me. I didn't really sort of think about why the teams were sponsored by the companies they were sponsored by initially. And I didn't really appreciate either that, you know, Lavie Claire at the time was a kind of new kid on the block, funded by Bernard Tapie, you know, a sort of arriviste in professional cycling, and that the real kind of aristocracy of French cycling was the Peugeot team at that time, and that they stretched back to sort of the certainly the early 60s, maybe even the late 50s. And so all of these sort of layers were things that kind of, you know, more than any other sport, I think professional cycling is like an onion. You peel away and you kind of learn a little bit more and a little bit more. And I don't think that's terribly different now. If you were arriving at this sport now to see that, you know, who are the big dominant teams, you might be puzzled that, you know, Ineos used to be Sky, or, you know, why have Movistar been around for so long, but Bahrain Merida have sort of evolved out of, you know, a sort of, who have they evolved out of? That's completely slipped my mind. Anyone help?
Lamprey a little bit. It was a kind of
UAE. I mean, UAE as well.
UAE, isn't it?
It's kind of, so it is. Yeah, it is. That's why I was confused. Yeah. Those two teams have kind of can trace their roots back to a similar origins. And I think on the broader point, you know, people do support individuals. I mean, if your favourite rider was Primoz Roglic and he left Jumbo-Visma to join somebody else, you wouldn't stop liking Primoz Roglic, I don't think, would you? I'm trying to think, put myself in the position of a fan. I don't think that you would. And so the teams are kind of here today, gone tomorrow, in a way. And that is one of the big problems of the business model, isn't it? Because we have a situation where longevity doesn't necessarily mean, you know, dominance. I mean, AG2R, La Mondiale have been around for 20 plus years and really haven't, you know, they're still kind of, you know, they're not really in the top six, are they? They're sort of a more of a middle ranking team. They have good years and bad. They have good riders come along for a while and shine very brightly, but they're kind of you know, they're mid table type team. So just being around for a long time doesn't necessarily ensure that you're competing at the top end either. It all really comes down to money, and in that sense, probably the World Tour is the most capitalist of sports, because it doesn't even have the kind of revenue sharing aspects that the big American leagues have, and even the Premier League has. I mean, you can finish bottom of the Premier League and still make enormous sums of money, which will assist the club's bid to get promoted back to the Premier League. Whereas in cycling, if you're struggling and your sponsor pulls out, you know, the entire organisation is ripe either for a merger or could disappear altogether, as we have seen in recent years.
Daniel, do you have any views, Daniel, on which teams have managed to sort of engage fans and have fans support the team rather than just the individual riders?
Well, I think if you look at the World Tour, I'm just looking down the list now, and the majority of the teams do have, in my mind at least, a fairly strong, solid identity, which can be linked to various things. In some cases, it's personality-led. You know, when I think of maybe Groupama FDJ, I think of Marc Madiot, the team manager, and I think of Thibaut Pinot. But then I also think of the colours, and I also think of the nationality. You know, the ones De Koninck, Quickstep, that you think of, well, you think of a heritage, you think of a style of riding, you think of Belgium, and you think of Patrick Lefebvre. There are three or four teams, I think, who haven't necessarily had enough time or haven't successfully established a really strong identity yet. Bahrain is one, partly maybe because they come from a place or their identity is tied to a country which has no real cycling heritage. There are also misgivings that people have about Bahrain's involvement in cycling. And, you know, they've now got a British team manager. They've got a Slovenian Croatian, or a big block of Slovenian Croatian staff members. And they've got a very international roster of riders. So much harder there. They don't really have an emblematic rider. They did have Nibali. He left. Trek Segafredo is another one, which I think people are a bit uncertain about their identity. Half American, half Italian, again, very international roster of riders. So I think it varies and it's very multifaceted. And
so interesting you don't mention Ineos there, because to my mind, you've obviously had a lot of success, but you know, if you just look at social media, I'm not sure how much of a gauge that is, but Ineos Grenadiers really, you know, have a much bigger following there on social media than all the other teams. I think Deceuninck Quickstep's the closest, and it's got, they've got sort of half the number of people following them on social media. I don't know how much of a gauge that really is, but I'm conscious of fans of that team being out there and fans of Deceuninck Quickstep, but I think they have quite successfully built fans, and partly that's a national kind of identity as well.
But I think if you go to the Tour of Flanders, whilst Lotto Soudal and Deceuninck Quickstep are the kind of Belgian teams, if you ask the average Flandrian standing by the side of the road who they would prefer to win, a Flandrian rider or Julian Alaphilippe for Deceuninck Quickstep, they would prefer probably the Flandrian. I mean, that's a generalisation, but I think it does split more along sort of national lines than the actual professional team lines. And, you know, if a top Spanish rider rides for Movistar, that's a bonus for Movistar, but Spaniards are not going to not support a Spanish rider if he's riding for, Trek Segafredo or, Bora Hansgro or any of the other trade teams. So,
and Napalm, I think that's hugely excessively influenced by the media. And the media, it never ceases to amaze me how, particularly television, is incredibly parochial. And they really push the agenda of kind of national interests, and consequently, well, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
But do you not think that somebody in Spain watching cycling isn't going to be bothered if the top Spanish rider rides for Movistar or rides for another team? Their view of that rider is not going to change necessarily because of the team that they're riding for, is it?
I don't know. You have these teams over the years that have been almost de facto national teams. I think Movistar, particularly now with only one Spanish World Tour team, they fulfill that role. Rabobank did for years, and I suppose Jumbo-Visma do to a certain extent still in the Netherlands, although Sunweb is also really, I still think of it as a Dutch team. Ineos in United Kingdom. I guess it depends on the individual fan, doesn't it? That really resonates with some people. It doesn't with others. It certainly wouldn't resonate with me.
Just to go back, Richard, to what we were saying about Bahrain, McLaren and UAE Team Emirates. UAE evolved directly out of the Lamprey setup, whereas Bahrain McLaren was a new team as Bahrain Merida in 2017. And the reason that we got confused perhaps about the Lamprey connection there is because Merida was the long-time bike supplier to Lamprey, wasn't it? So, you know, that's the other thing. The sort of the family tree of the World Tour is pretty complicated, and can, it can be quite hard to unpick which teams evolved out of which. But in terms of sort of an identity, I do think EF Pro Cycling have done well when you consider that they were so wedded to the Argyle pattern. You know, that did resonate with some fans, and it kind of gave them that, college boy preppy type, veneer, didn't it? And they've kind of shaken that off a bit, and they've adopted, you know, the bright pink, and they've got a real kind of South American flavor running through the core of that team as well, and I think that has increased their popularity, certainly in South America.
Although Lionel, without wanting to offend anyone, when I think of that team, I still do think of Jonathan Vaughters in a tweed waistcoat and very manicured facial hair and a preppy vibe, which, you know, is will turn some people off and others will be drawn to.
Do you think once they've gone through the pink phase, they'll maybe maybe tweed bib shorts is the next thing for them. I don't know.
Well, possibly, but they have been successful, like you say, in creating an identity which transcends, you know, whoever their sponsor is, whatever their colours are. I mean, it's a smell, it's a flavour, it's almost a taste in the mouth. It's something intangible that when you think of that team, certain feelings come up.
I was going to suggest, maybe not as a whole episode, but if you remember a few years ago, Daniel, your idea, the ethical report on the sponsors in the World Tour, which went down both very well and dreadfully with the listeners. We could
like
do
a lot of my output.
We could do a sort of word association game. That, you know, those intangibles. When you think of a team, what do you think of? I mean, I know I kind of make a joke of it, but it's a joke because there's an element of truth to it. I struggle when teams change sponsors, when they change colours. You know, it takes a few races before you realise what you're looking for. And in terms of trying to build a sort of strong legacy and, a brand and, you know, an income stream, really, which comes out of that sense of identity, when the teams are changing their colours and they're changing their title names, year in, year out, it doesn't necessarily help to sort of bedrock those foundations. And I suppose, you know, when you look at the teams that have been around the longest, they really have stayed more or less the same, haven't they? Lotto has been involved with the Lotto Soudal team either as title or secondary sponsor for a long, long time. You know, Cofidis, Groupama, FDJ, although they've changed the title sponsor, still have the very Madio-esque French red, white and blue.
Well, we should, Napalm, I propose that we do that exercise at some point, and providing that it takes place in US marketing guy's office, possibly overlooking Central Park, and it should be adjudicated by Timmy Mallett. That's a reference.
Mallett's Mallett, yeah. Unfortunately, US marketing guy is deceased. He died in that terrible accident, shredding some contracts, and his tie got caught in the shredder and met a messy end. So US marketing guy won't be there, but I'm sure somebody shady is paying the rent on his office.
American listeners, look up Timmy Mallett and Mallett's Mallett.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Thank you, Seb, reminding me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Stitch Fix, which is an online personal stylist to help liven up your wardrobe and take the stress out of shopping for clothes. At the moment, a lot of clothes shops are maybe closed, and so online shopping is the way to go out of necessity. And the issue with that is that it's difficult to tell online what things look like and whether they're going to fit. And Stitch Fix has got the solution to that. Anyway, it struck me that this time last year, we were on our tour of live shows, travelling around the country. And before that, I entrusted Stitch Fix to pick out some clothes for me. And they came up trumps with a jacket, a couple of shirts, and some trousers that really fitted well. And, I thought they looked pretty good, for me anyway. The thing about Stitch Fix is that their stylists know the different brands and how they size up against one another so they can shop efficiently for you. This year, my requirements have been slightly different because we've all been at home a lot more. But my most recent fix included a really comfortable hoodie and a pair of jeans that I've been wearing around the house. To get started, you complete an online quiz at stitchfix.co.uk/cycling, and you give your stylist an idea of what colours and styles you like and what your budget is, and then let the stylist do the rest. So go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling to set up your profile and get started. There's a £10 styling fee for each fix, but that is taken off the cost of any items that you choose to buy. Shopping, returns and exchanges are all free, and there's no subscription either. You can schedule your fixes as frequently as you want them. So get started today at stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Do use the name of the podcast, The Cycling Podcast, because if you sign up at stitchfix.co.uk/cycling, you'll be supporting us as well as getting some great additions for your wardrobe. So that's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. And the details are also in the show notes.
My name's Richard Lambert. I'm a friend of the podcast. Question for Lizzie. With the forced retirement of Ian Stannard, quite sadly this week, with rheumatoid arthritis, got me thinking why Ineos are so poor when it comes to the monuments, the classics, the one-day races. Everything seems to be all in for, you know, the Grand Tours, and especially the Tour de France. So I just wondered why it is you think, with a a team with such a budget and such limitless resources don't go for riders like Evenepoel or someone like that, or Van Aert, that could actually win them some classics?
Well, that's a great point, Richard. And it's a really interesting question. But I would say that the answer is the same reason why De Koninck Quickstep are so prolific in one-day races, but don't, until this year with Joao Almeida, really, you know, have the success in Grand Tours. You know, the focus of Ineos, you know, when it started as Team Sky, they wanted to be a British Grand Tour winner. And they went and achieved that goal. And I think that they were so focused on that goal of Grand Tour success that the success in the one-day races kind of got lost along the way. If you're so focused on getting all of your riders into the right shape and the right peak performance for the Grand Tours, then you lose the ability to be able to focus on the specific things that you need to do in training in order to target the one-day races. But you're right, they have such a big budget that they could afford to kind of spread things a bit more evenly. But sometimes you go to a team because you know that the culture of the team and the way the team races and the way the team trains means that everything is going to be kind of, yeah, focused onto one goal. And the way that you ride is going to be kind of focused more towards one goal. And obviously with Ineos, that's Grand Tours. And obviously with De Koninck Quickstep, that's one day races. So I think you're right. I think that they do have the budget to be able to spread their focus into more places. And perhaps we'll see this. You know, Dave Brailsford said that he wants to do more attacking racing. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, I think that they have the budget, but really their focus is Grand Tours, and their focus will probably remain as Grand Tours.
Hey, Richard, I touched on your question the other day on the final episode of the Grandest Tour when I had mentioned that the sports physiologist at Team Sky fully understand the physiological demands of winning a monument, but they also understand the demands of winning a Grand Tour. And because the team at Ineos has focused so much on winning the Grand Tour and the Tour de France in particular, that they realize that their classic specialists are also incredibly valuable riders at a race such as the Tour de France. So I believe that the team is not entirely committed to giving those riders such as Luke Rowe, Ian Stannard, Kwiatkowski, a training plan specific for the classics. They need those riders to be good at the classics, but they really need those riders to be at their best when it comes to the Grand Tour, supporting whoever their leader may be and whoever their leader may be next year. And it's one of those things that, you know, they've specialized in Grand Tours. And I think that the team, the sponsors, the riders, when they join a team such as Ineos, they know full well what the goals and what the objectives are. And riders may be willing to sacrifice some of their own ambitions to be part of a Tour de France winning team. That said, over the years, the team has won a few monuments. I remember Wout Poels won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Kwiatkowski won Milan-San Remo. So the team is, they are still competitive, but I guess when you compare it to their performances in the Grand Tour, it's not quite on par. And I would attribute that to the fact of how the riders are training and preparing for the spring classics and the monuments.
Hi chaps, Adam Cotham here, friend of the podcast. My question is, Mitchelton Scott had been one of the real developing teams in the GC status, but this past 12-18 months it feels they've really taken a bit of a backward step, with not much to shout about apart from a few days in yellow this year. With Adam Yates leaving and talk of discontent amongst the riders due to the pay cuts, what next for Mitchelton Scott? Where do they go from here?
Thanks for your question, Adam. Mitchelton Scott, a team we should probably have mentioned in the context of teams having a strong identity. They've had a strong Australian identity, even when, you know, they've had non-Australian leaders such as Simon Yates, Esteban Chavez, Adam Yates. Either of you, Daniel, do you have a view on this, whether Mitchelton Scott have taken a step backwards?
It's a good question. Certainly, on paper, they haven't had the greatest of seasons, although they did pick up a couple of World Tour stage race wins, Adam Yates at UAE, Simon Yates at Tirreno. But the Yates brothers have had quite a checkered last two or three years as far as Grand Tours are concerned. A couple of times, that I don't know whether they've got their preparation wrong or, you know, they've suffered mishaps in some cases along the way, but they haven't performed up to, they haven't lived up to expectations. And of course, Adam Yates is leaving, and you know, you look at the number of GC riders that Ineos are going to have in their ranks next year. And while you can understand the wisdom of Yates wanting to move there, try something different, he talks about becoming more consistent in stage races. You just wonder whether Ineos are going to have too many big hitters to fit into the three Grand Tours. I mean, I've seen another report this morning in Spain about Vlasov moving from Astana possibly this year to Ineos, which well, the mind just boggles at the number of GC riders that Ineos are accumulating. So Yates moving, Chavez again, there was further evidence at the Vuelta that he's still a long way from what he was 3 or 4 years ago. So they're left with Yates, really, as a GC rider, and they put out a press release a couple of days ago, which I thought was an interesting move, talking about Lewis Hamilton's credentials as a leader. Lucas Hamilton's
credentials. Well, I mean, my theory was Lucas Hamilton could have finished on the podium at the Giro had he not had to pull out.
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. He's shown an awful lot of potential the last couple of years, but it is potential at this stage. We don't know how he measures up to the new wave of other GC riders that are emerging across several different teams. He will, well, it sounds as though he's going to be their leader in one of the big tours next year. But, you know, is he a guy who's good enough to finish 6th, 7th or 8th? Or is he a guy who's going to challenge? Really, they need someone in the latter category in order
Michael Matthews, of course, going back.
And they're one of the teams with a lot of places that are still unaccounted for, a lot of places in their roster that haven't been filled yet. I think they've got 15 riders at the moment under contract for 2021, so I expect some announcements from them in the next few days. But I think their budget will be smaller next year, and whether they're going to add another GC rider, I'm not sure. I see the emphasis shifting slightly back towards one day races with Matthews.
Yeah, I think that's a smart move as well. It sort of takes the pressure off the GC riders and gives them more of an impact in a lot of different classics with Michael Matthews. I mean, Francois is probably Matthews' biggest advocate, isn't he? And he thinks he could win everything from, you know, Milan-San Remo to the World Championships and even cobbled classics or hilly classics. I mean, he doesn't, that's the problem. No, that's true, but maybe back in an environment where he older, maturer, there's not likely to be a big rivalry between him and anyone else that he's had in the past. Certainly when he was last with this team, you know, it was always him and Simon Gerrans who were so similar and going, you know, wanted to have the leadership role on the same day. So maybe that will free him up a little bit. But moving away from the GC, you know, they did definitely have a strategy and, nearly came off, didn't it? They nearly won a Giro, but not quite. So, yeah, change of direction for them.
I have a lot of faith that the enthusiasm and the acumen of Matt White, who's very much, well, calls a lot of the shots as far as the sporting side of that team is concerned. As long as he's there, I think that team will always do relatively well. And I think, you know, he's got his eye as well, always carefully sort of trained on what's happening in the under 23 ranks. And he's always looking out for new talent. And I think they'll recruit well, and they've also got Marco Pinotti joining the technical staff from CCC, who's going to be a huge asset. So I think that team will always give a good account of itself. But it might be a bit of a transitional year next year.
And with Lewis Hamilton in the team car, I mean, who can stop them?
Hello, Duart Snow, friend of the podcast here. A question for Francois dans le coin français. Wondering when Française des Jeux Groupama put their money on Arnaud Démare and David Gaudu in the Tour de France instead of Thibaut Pinot. Thank you. Bye.
So my answer to Dirt about Pinot, I mean, we all know a friend of the podcast who won't be happy to, you know, about your question and kind of ruling out Pinot of the picture completely. Well, for Arnaud Démare, obviously, it started, you know. Marc Madiot, the Française des Jeux manager, has always been a great fan of Arnaud Démare. Always believed he could win lots and be one of the best sprinters in the world, and maybe more. I think at the back of his mind, Maggio would really love for Arnaud Démare to win Paris-Roubaix. I don't think I don't know if it's feasible, but it's something he would really like to see happen. But maybe it'll be wiser to keep Démare, given his strengths, current strengths, to collect stages in Grand Tours. We'll see what they do. As for Gaudu, we discussed that many times. The Maggio brothers and all the Groupama FDJ people like are kind of the tenants of the old school that considered that you had to wait for a rider to reach 25, 26, maybe 27 to be at its prime to go for a Grand Tour, and Gaudu is only 24. So unlike the other teams did for Pogacar or Bernal, and they decided to kind of put the brakes on Gaudu's destiny, to not to kind of spoil him, and we still don't know whether it was wise or not, because you never know whether Bernal will win a second Grand Tour, and we never know whether Pogacar will win a second Grand Tour. They've only won one yet, and maybe the caution in the handling of Gaudu's career was worthwhile. We don't know. We'll know in 5 or 6 years' time, and maybe we'll see that the old school notions and approach was the good one. Who knows? We don't know for sure. Anyways, because of Pinot's terrible season, Gaudu, shone to the limelight in the Vuelta, winning two of the big mountain stages. So obviously, Gaudu will now be a real Grand Tour leader and GC contender for Groupama FDJ. My impression is that these days, most World Tour teams need two or three, maybe four or five, if they're strong, Grand Tour riders, because the schedule is so tight, heavy, and you can't anymore, base all your season around one person. So, Démare for the sprints and the classics. Pinot for one of the Grand Tours. Maybe he's more suited actually for the Giro and the Vuelta than for the Tour de France, and Gaudu for the Grand Tour that Pinot won't be going for. I think it'll be probably premature and a bit insensitive to get rid of Thibaut Pinot and to rule him out completely now, because he had yet another bad season. Look at his record. Look at what he's won in the past. Look at his potential. He's not finished. I know it's going to be hard for him. He's been struggling a lot, and probably more mentally than physically as well. I really think he deserves a last chance, and maybe it'll be the right one. Whether it's on the Tour of the Giro, but on the Vuelta, I still think Pinot has it in him to win a Grand Tour if one day at long last things click into place. But obviously, as well, the present belongs to Démare and the future belongs to Gaudu.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code at the checkout, SISCP25. A few of you had a few problems with the code in the last week or so. But it is now working okay. There were problems with it for a couple of days, and a few of you got in touch. It is now working. So SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com for 25% off all your Science and Sport products. Let's go to our next question.
Hello, this is Ian from Somerset. My question is about the Nice area and the French Riviera and why it became such a big base for cyclists and international cyclists in particular, and when it started.
Hey, Ian. Well, you would have to speak to Francois as far as why Nice and the Riviera became a popular area for cyclists prior to the early 1990s. But I do know that around early 1990, a lot of the North American riders and Australians moved to the Nice area. It is a phenomenal place to train. There's a convenient airport. And there was actually a little bit of an exodus from Nice in probably the late 90s, early 2000s. A lot of that was actually due to doping. And doping in France became a criminal offense. So a lot of the riders who were using illicit substances moved to Girona or elsewhere. But there was kind of a rebirth of riders moving to the Nice, Monaco area, kind of around the time that I turned pro in 2013. I moved there with Joe Dombrowski. We were the only two Americans in Nice. There have always been quite a few pros in Monaco, tended to be riders on big salaries. Monaco is a tax-free residency for those who come from a country that allows that. As North Americans or as American riders, we cannot avoid taxes. So regardless of where we live, we pay taxes. But in the last few years, Nice has really blown up as a place for pro cyclists to move. As I said, the training is phenomenal. It's in many ways, one of the most convenient places in Europe to be. You're really central. You know, there's the airport in Nice has flights almost directly to anywhere. And the training is great. And I think one thing that I was really drawn to by moving to Nice, first off, the Team Sky, Team Ineos now has a small base there. And they really wanted to make that area a hub where we could actually, as riders, train together on a regular basis, similar to a football team or other sports teams. But the fact that Nice is a big enough city for athletes is something that I really enjoyed. You know, there's other cities in Europe, Girona in particular, where there's a large group of cyclists, but it's a small enough city that you wind up coming across other pro cyclists relatively frequently. One thing I loved about Nice was that, you know, you really did feel like you were just a citizen of the city, and you could go out to a bar, a restaurant, grocery store, and you're not going to necessarily run into other cyclists, which is nice. But there are enough athletes in the area that if you want to connect and meet up, then you're able to do that. And I really enjoyed my time in Nice. And for any of you who are looking to travel on a cycling holiday when this pandemic is over, I would highly recommend checking out Nice and the French Riviera.
So this is a question from Dominic Stobart in Pelham, just outside New York City in the United States. And it's a question for Daniel. And it relates to a reference to a story that Daniel made maybe a couple of years ago at the Vuelta with regards eggs and one of the riders. It was either Oscar Ferrer or Omar Fraile. And Daniel sort of hinted that there'd been some kind of incident involving an egg and either Oscar Ferreira or Omar Fraile. And there was some very amusing story, but he either never told it or I missed the episode where he did. I think it was the former because I'm a fairly committed listener. So the question is, what is the story involving the egg? Thanks.
Well, that's intriguing. Daniel, can you shed any light on the egg?
I think I know what he's referring to. And I do believe I stopped short of telling this story, probably because we're pressed for time. Anyway, 2000, let me take you back, chaps. 2004, Milan San Remo. Oscar Freire, the first, I think, of Oscar Freire's three Milan San Remo victories. He was ably assisted in the finale, by Eric Decker, his Rabobank teammate. And so much so that...
And Omar Fraile is nowhere to be
nowhere
seen
to
here,
be
Daniel.
Seen, nowhere to be seen. So much so that Freire, you know, he celebrated his victory and then, you know, slammed on the brakes and he was embraced by soigneurs. And the first teammate he saw was Eric Decker, who'd done a fantastic job, as I said, in positioning him coming into the last bend. And, you know, big embrace. And Oscar Freire... At that time, his English wasn't great, but there's an expression in Spanish, te quiero un huevo, I love you, an egg, literally. But he literally said, I think in English, he said, I love you eggs, to Eric Decker. Eric Decker replied, well, you know, Oscar, I would do anything for you. You know, I would do anything. I would have done anything to give you that victory. And all he kept hearing was, I love your eggs. I love your eggs. Anyway, Eric Decker rode off in the direction of the Rabobank team bus. I don't know if you chaps ever... Did you do Milan-San Remo in those days? There was... There was, 2 kilometres of straight road off the finish line. The buses were way down by the old station in San Remo. And anyway, Decker rode down and he couldn't get this out of his head. He was, I love you, Eric. But he thought that there was a... that Frere was making some kind of request. He thought that, you know, from Frere's expression, that he actually, that he wanted an egg for some reason. Anyway, he went back to the bus, and he was being congratulated by all the masseurs and the mechanics. Decker was, and meanwhile, Frere was on his way to the podium. But Decker couldn't get this out of his head, that Frere wanted an egg. And he thought, anyway, it would be funny if when Frere got back to the team bus, the Rabobank team bus, he could present him with this egg, in the guise of a kind of celebration. So instead of putting his bike down, he got back on his bike and he rode, and there are numerous shops up that road, and there's a supermarket, I think it was an Esse Lunga, one of the big chains in Italy. And he parked his bike outside and he got one of the cashiers to sort of watch it for him. And he walked down the aisle in his cleats, and got up and down the aisles, and he found the eggs finally. But he's clopping around in these cleats, and on his way to the checkout, he slips, and these eggs smash all over the floor, and he's caked. He gets them all over his hands. He's completely caked in egg. In his lycra, and he peels off his jersey, and he's only wearing bib shorts, but they're soaked in egg. But by this point, 20 minutes have passed since he'd seen Frere behind the finish line, and he's gone too far. He's got to come back with the egg now. He's gone to such trouble, so he goes into a bar, and he asks if they can give him an egg, and they said no, but we've got a frittata, the omelette there. We'll give you a frittata. And they give him this frittata on a little plate. So he's still on his Colnago, riding back with a little plate and a frittata on it in one hand. And he gets back and he goes on the bus and he's, big smile. Can't believe that he's pulled this off. Got Oscar the egg. And Oscar comes back. Oscar Egg. Didn't Oscar Egg, wasn't he?
Yeah, Oscar Egg. Oscar Egg. Our record holder.
Yeah. He broke the our record.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if they were Frere Range eggs.
Anyway, he's sitting there on the bus. Still, he stinks of egg as well because he's still got this raw egg pouring down the inside of his thigh. And anyway, Frere finally gets on the bus. And Decker says, no, I got you an egg. You said you wanted an egg. And Frere says to him, what do you mean? I'm allergic to eggs.
Oh, amazing.
Amazing story. Completely.
Well, I can see why time limitations may have prevented you telling that story in a previous episode.
Amazing story, completely made up.
What an astonishing anecdote.
Completely 100% invented.
Before we go, a quick reminder that you can join the cycling podcast community at LACA if you want to be a part of a group of cyclists all cooperating to provide insurance cover for bikes and equipment. Go to laca.co.uk and use the code TCP when you sign up. That's laka.co.uk with the code TCP. LACA is collective insurance cover made especially for cyclists, so they really know what it is they're covering. And at the moment, they are crowdfunding as well to finance the next stage of the company's investment, and anyone can invest from £10 and become a part of LACA's future that way as well.
Well, this has been part one of our press conference post the Grandest Tour. We got so many questions and we had so many people answering the questions, thanks to Lizzie Banks, Ian Boswell and Francois Thomazeau as well, that we have split this episode over 2 weeks. So part two will come next week. There's lots of other stuff out at the moment as well. Cycling Podcast Femina for November was released this week. Also, our special with Theo Gegenhart, the winner of the Giro, Theo's Giro. That's an hour-long conversation with him talking all the way through the race. That has been released for Friends of the Cycling Podcast. Coming next week is our special episode with Orla Shinawy, the life and times of Orla Shinawy. That's been waiting to be released. It will come out next week for Friends of the Podcast again. If you would like to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. But that's all for this week. We'll be back with more questions next week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.